Craftsman Days are here at Lowe's with big savings on the tools you need. Right now, get a free select tool when you buy the Craftsman V20 2-Pack Battery Kit. Whether it's the backyard, the bathroom, or beyond, Craftsman has the tools to help you power through and get the project done right. Because DIYing is unpredictable, but your tools shouldn't be. Shop Craftsman at Lowe's today. Valid through 6/18 while supplies last. Selection varies by location.
Welcome back to another episode of Trading Secrets. I'm your host, Jason Tardik, and welcome to the pre-market trading segment where I'm going to tell you a little bit about our guest, an update from the market, and something from my personal life before we ring in the bell. Now, this episode, do you guys remember Entourage? One of the best TV shows in the history of TV shows from a performance perspective, nationally, internationally, and of course, on HBO. If you've never seen the show, no worries. You're going to hear from someone that was in law school. Mom and dad said, you gotta go. Ended up dropping out, practicing, and then pursuing stand-up comedy, and then goes on to write one of the best TV shows in the entire history of TV shows. You're gonna hear about what it was like for him to pitch to HBO executives, how many times they told him to go back to the chalkboard. I gotta warn you, there's a story in here that's definitely R-rated. Of what Doug Ellen, the writer and creator of Entourage, had to do to get his mind right. He is funny. He has got an unbelievable, imaginative, creative type of brain. And you're going to learn so much about pursuing your passions and just the behind the scenes of TV. And you'll hear about some stories of his good friend, David Schwimmer. We all know Ross from Friends. So just a lot of action here. Some of the numbers we're going to get into regarding the show, but we do talk about Entourage the movie, and I have these numbers in front of me. 2015, it came out. Domestic box office, they did $32 million. International box office, $14 million. Worldwide total, $46 million. They did estimated 1.6 in DVD sales and 1.7 million in Blu-ray sales. So domestically, from a video perspective, 3.3 million. And yes, these were the days DVDs and Blu-rays. Oh my God, Blu-rays. Remember those? Were around. Now you're going to hear they were disappointed with some of these results, and we'll talk all about that. But if you adjust for inflation, in like you're looking at today, domestically they did around $41 million. That's just the movie. So wait till you hear more about the TV show. And stay tuned to the recap, because David and I really get into the weeds on all things Entourage. Now, an update from this market. People's debt in the United States is off the charts right now. Total household debt at the end of Q2 2024, $17.8 trillion. This is a record in absolute terms, but not as far as inflation adjusted basis. The change in the last quarter, a $5 billion increase. The average debt per household, $148,266. And total debt to deposit ratio and total debt to asset ratio is over 20% below historical average. So what this is telling us, this is a Wallet Hub study, that in general, our debt to our assets are up and our debt in general in the United States is up. Debt can be good or bad. If debt is connected to depreciating assets, it's bad. Appreciating assets, it's good. We have to know bad debt must be taken care of. And you have to do your due diligence before you do take out debt to make sure that you can service the debt with your current cash flow. Update for my personal life, what a weekend. We had an unbelievable time in the Hamptons, did a campaign at Bounce Montauk with Velveeta cheese. That was so much fun. We then went to the Patron House, saw a ton of people that, my mind's running right now, but we went to a recording of Summer House. So we saw all the cast of Summer House, saw Joey and Kelsey at the Patron House, was with Alex, John, Kat, Evan, and Betsy. Just had so much fun. I feel like no matter where you are, yeah, Hamptons are cool and stuff, but it's all about the people you're with. And we all together just had the time of our lives. This week, I'll be in New York City all week doing some podcasting. Really excited. We got Ryan Serhant coming back on. And actually, my brother's going to come on the podcast. So it's the first time I've had a family member on the podcast and the business behind his Broadway marketing firm and so much more. And yes, we will get into the weeds on just our life growing up. So if you have questions that you want me to ask my brother, please go to Apple or Spotify right now. Give us 5 stars and put your question in the review. Now, enough of me, enough of the Hamptons, enough of the market and debt. Let's get in to the podcast, the main episode with the one and only Doug Ellen, the creator of Entourage. Welcome back to another episode of Trading Secrets. Today, I am joined by Emmy-nominated director, producer, screenwriter, and podcast host, Doug Ellen. Doug is most well known for creating the hit HBO series Entourage, ever heard of it, in which he held roles as executive producer and director. Between 2004 and 2011, the show amassed 96 episodes while collecting 26 Emmy nominations and 6 Emmy winners, and eventually adapting its own movie screenplay based around the characters and plot of the show, which Rob G made an appearance on. You guys know Rob Gronkowski's been on this show. Since the show's end in 2011, Doug has continued to feed off the high level of interest and success of the show by creating a podcast called Victory the Podcast. Go check it out right now. Co-hosted with Kevin Connolly, Kevin Dillon, giving insights of the brain trust of the show's success over the years. In addition to the podcast, Doug has spun off to a new upcoming show titled Ramble on TV. This is a show starring some of Entourage's former cast members. We're going to get into all the ins and outs of one of Hollywood's most intriguing screenwriters on how he's been able to capitalize off a major success in entertainment and continue his career in writing new TV shows. Doug, thank you so much for being here on Trading Secrets.
Thanks for having me. And actually, I did win one Emmy, which is a little known thing, and they didn't even show it. So when people come to my house and they see it, they go, "What is this?" And they think it's fake, but it was real. So I won for a doc on the Knicks.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Okay. With Brad before, right?
Yep.
Yep. ESPN 30 for 30. I remember that. We looked into this. I could have done your intro for the whole podcast. Your resume is insane.
It's all right.
All right. Let's get into just kind of the career direction. I think everyone, when they hear about someone that's in a career such as yours and has done what you've done, they're just intrigued. You know, people don't want to be an accountant. It's a little boring to be a teacher at times, but they hear about your career and they just want to know everything. So you started off, right, as a comic, and then you wrote 2 independent movies. Before you even got in this, did you go to school? Did you have to go to film school? How do you prepare to even get into this?
So it's interesting you say, my dad was an accountant.
Okay.
And a lawyer. And I went to Tulane and graduated in 90. And in 90, it's like a different world. There's no internet and there's no anything. So the film business is some imaginary thing that's in Hollywood that you don't have any idea how to get into. So I was going to law school, and about a week before I graduated, I said, there's no way I can do this. And I told my parents I was moving to LA to do stand-up comedy, which,
dad loved that.
You could not even imagine their reactions. First of all, my dad said, I didn't even know you were funny, was his first comment. But I literally came out here. I knew no one except for my wife-to-be who I'd met on the phone. And I came to LA and I moved into her parents' house for 3 months. And that's what I started. And I didn't know a single person out here.
Got it. So then how do you get the skill set to start writing independent movies and start writing like this? Where
that's
does this
the
develop?
Beauty of this bit. You don't need any skills, you know?
Is that how this works out here?
I mean, it pretty much is, you know? I mean, the thing is, obviously, to me, this business is talent and work ethic. Those are the two things you need. If you don't have any talent, and a lot of people go, this guy doesn't have talent, even though he made it. Most people who make it have a talent. You know, they may not be your favorite. They may not be this. But what you really need is the work ethic and the perseverance. And I came out here, started doing stand-up. I took 2 things I did. I took a screenwriting class at UCLA Extension, which was like a night class where nobody had any experience in the business. And then I took a class at the Improv, which was like a stand-up class. Again, people from all walks of life could walk in and you'd do a couple of months and then they'd put you up at the Improv. You'd get on a stage.
Yeah.
And I actually, my first time ever doing stand-up, I don't know if you know who Mario Joyner is, but he's a pretty, you know, successful comedian. And when I was 21, I worked for 3 months in this class, get ready to get on this stage. And right before I get on, the owner goes in, before this next amateur gets on, we have a special guest coming in, Mario Joyner, who is a real successful comedian. He does an hour.
Puts the pressure
kills
on.
It. And I have it on tape, but I was introduced as I feel bad for this next amateur to follow that. And that was my intro into all of this.
That's awesome. And it all worked out. But I also think about so many careers have a blueprint. They have a systematic way of getting to where you have to go. Obviously, it was more of an art than a science for you. We talk money on this podcast. I know you had two independent movies, which I want to talk about. One, you got 100K for. One with David Schwimmer, you got $1.5 million. Before we even get into that, how much money are you making at some of the jobs that you're taking on to start building this profile within the space that you're trying to really launch into?
I mean, obviously, you know, my parents going, which they said, we'll give you a year. And that wasn't a year with like, here's, you know, a couple of $1 million. They gave me, I think, $1,500 a month. They said, you got a year to figure it out. And then that's it. And I got very lucky. I went to that UCLA class.
Yep.
And what it was, as I said, you need talent. And yeah. Most of the kids in that class did not have any. And the first day, the teacher said, next week, come in and pitch me a movie you want to make. And the week after, all the kids or people, they weren't even some kids. Some were, you know, older adults. They all pitched ideas and they were so awful that I went back to the job that I did have, which was I was the head of the mailroom at New Line Cinema. I think I probably was making $400 or $500 a week. I was the head, by the way.
Head.
So I was the, I was running.
It always starts in a mailroom. You know, everyone who's done it all, it always starts
It really does, although times I think are changing now.
Sure.
But that was like, it was a big gig that I got. And I actually talked my way into the head job, which was, you know, caused a lot of controversy in the mailroom. Who is this guy? Why is he getting the head job? So I got to tell people, you know, deliver that envelope first and that one second. That was the big key. But actually, interestingly enough, I mean, one of the other kids in the mailroom was this guy, Tommy O'Haver, who ended up having a successful career. He made some Sundance films and he's directed some movies. So, you know, that a lot of people do start in that way. But after these kids all pitched their movie idea, I said, you know what I got to do? I got to make a short film. And honestly, that short film led to everything that I've ever done. So I begged, borrowed, and stole to get the money to make this. And as I said, I was in the mailroom at New Line. I did a stand-up show to raise money, handed out flyers to everyone at New Line. And I don't even know why he came, but Mike DeLuca, who's now Oscar-winning producer, and I think he's head of Warner Brothers films now, he came to the show and he wrote me a check for $10,000 for this short film. And I went out and got people, David Schwimmer, pre-friends, Ernie Hudson from Ghostbusters and Oz, Johnny Silverman from Weekend at Bernie's and a million other things. And they were all people I just met through people around town. And I made this little short film that took, which would take, by the way, I could make this film on an iPhone in an hour today. Probably took 6 months to get it all shot, edited, and done. And somebody saw it and gave it to people at Showtime and they bought it and put it on Showtime when they used to show some short films on it. Got me my first agent, got me into the American Film Institute, which I went to for a year, and that kind of led to everything. So I always tell everybody, just go make something, you know, don't wait, go figure it out and go make it. So
yeah. So we talk a lot about like, think about like a real estate transaction. I want to buy a commercial property. I can show you the financials. I can show you my deck. You'll know how much equity you get. I have an idea of return. I can show a lot of things.
Yeah.
In a business venture like this, it's a complete crapshoot.
Yeah.
Like, what are you actually doing to get people on board? And
it's
how
worse. It's worse than a crapshoot. I mean, to be honest with you, if you don't have bona fide stars in whatever you're doing, you're asking for favors and you're asking people to believe in you. And you're also asking because, as you know, being from business world, so many people want to enter the Hollywood business.
Of course.
So they're willing to go, you know what?
Sure.
I'm willing to lose money if I have a good experience. And you have to convince people that this is going to lead to a lot of the things that you'll do in the future, possibly with them. I was very lucky that everybody got their money back on this little short film. Rarely, I would say, can you ever look somebody in the face and go, hey, give me this money and I'm going to give you a 10X. It doesn't happen almost ever. So.
Give me the estimated odds of success. You write a show, you want to fundraise for it, you want to bring it to life. What do you think the likelihood of it being a success is based on everything you've seen? Percentage-wise?
Again, you have to have that talent and ability. Whatever the movies I did at first,
sure.
I obviously had something that ended up selling both the independent films I've had, but I would say 1 in 1 million.
What?
I mean, the amount of people that I know who go out and make films and lose their money. It's almost everybody I know. So I was very fortunate. I sold that first short film I did. I sold two independent features that I did, but I have a pilot right now with bona fide TV stars in it. And, you know, we have to go sell it. And it's no guarantee. Now the difference is we're trying to go, hey, we made a pilot. Now give us money to make, you know, 100 more of these things. So obviously we're asking for a big financial investment. Whereas an independent film, easier to sell, still incredibly hard. You know, you have to make something either sellable or good, you know?
Yeah. And that pilot that you're doing right now, Ramble On, it's a show that focuses on established stars looking for career reinvention, right? And that's a lot of the things that we talk about, restarts, rebranding, and everything like that. So we're going to get to Ramble On. But some of the thing that you said really stuck out to me when you said, I sold these films. I know you sold one for $100K that ended up, I think, on Showtime, the one with David Schwimmer, which is Moving, Kissing a Fool. That was for, I heard, $1.5 million with Universal. Yeah. When you sell them for that dollar amount, how much of that money ends up in your pocket?
So Fat Beach, which was the first one, which is, I mean, it's a crazy story. I just got out of film school. I made a short film. A producer saw it, which it's hard to picture, but in 1994, I think when we started this, the word PHAT was not a common word in the vernacular. And a producer called me up. He saw my short film and he said, I want you to direct this movie, Fat Beach. And I was like, Fat Bitch, what is it? And he's like, no, it's Fat Beach. And I read this script, which was, I mean, beyond awful, but I was being offered $11,000 to rewrite and direct this movie, $11,000. And we went and made, in 6 days, we shot this film with absolute chaos, mayhem, and the producer ran out of money. And about 9 months later, I showed it to a friend of mine, not the film, some dailies and stuff. He's like, we could sell this thing. I was like, okay. And he went and Live Entertainment at the time, which I forget who they became, but who released a lot of movies. They saw it. They gave us whatever number they gave us to finish this movie. And it wasn't released on Showtime. That movie came out on, I think, 400 screens and played worldwide, which was crazy because the budget of the movie was less than $200,000. So it's hard to find a movie that got that kind of release. And that movie's played on cable for the last 25 years. I mean, Complex did a 25-year retrospective on this movie, which is nuts. And allegedly, it's grossed about $11 million. What did I get paid? Nothing after that. Zero.
You got the 11,000.
I got the 11,000 and then some residuals. Yeah.
What is the likelihood that when it gets picked up and when a movie is purchased, that it will be successful? We already said 1 in a million that you'll make it, you'll get picked up. Then they buy it. Yeah. What is their risk level when they buy it, when a Universal buys it?
You know, it's hard to say, but I think it's pretty huge, you know? And I think that movie ultimately was successful. The choice to release it in movie theaters, I think, was a bit ambitious. I mean, there are some laughs in the movie and I have a great cast and, you know, Brian Hooks, who, you know, has had a great career for the last 30 years. I think that was the first thing he ever did. And Jermaine Hopkins, who's a really good actor. Coolio made a little appearance in it. And it was right when he started exploding, we got him. But the fact that they actually made money on that, I think, was pretty surprising. But, you know, for me as the filmmaker, what it was a chance to just get on and shoot something and then show people whatever it was. You know, Darren Aronofsky was a friend of mine from AFI, who's one of the biggest directors in the world. I mean, I had him do the second unit on that movie. That's, you know, cool. So he was like, before he ever worked on anything, he's doing this movie like that. So, you know, that's what filmmakers have to do. And then the financial risks, they're enormous. I mean, yeah. You know, that's why people don't understand why do they keep making superhero movies? Because they keep making money.
That's right.
You know, it's just that simple. And all the artists, which I don't really consider myself an artist per se, and I do understand business, you know, it's a huge risk. It's a risk to their jobs. It's a risk to their financial security of their companies. And they have to find things, whether they're right or wrong, that they believe will make money, you know?
Yeah. I mean, another huge risk, right? Mom and dad, they're giving you $1,500 a month. You got to sink or swim. We know that you swim tremendously at the Olympic level with Entourage, but between them giving you that $1,500 a month and then you making it big with Entourage, what was the biggest financial impact that you had received a reward from your work?
I was very lucky. My parents had to support me for about a year and I started making money I sold, you know, my first script. So I got very lucky.
What time period was that? How long did that take?
Less than 2 years.
Okay. So you were up and out pretty damn quick.
I mean, I was financially independent. Again, not wealthy by any stretch, but I didn't need my parents' money probably after 24 to 36 months out here. Mm-hmm. And I went to film school. So fortunately, they paid for that.
Okay.
But that's rare. I mean, I have friends that I'm still friends with on the 35-year journey here who still don't make a lot of money. And most of the people that I started out with don't make money. Again, I've had some friends who are wildly successful, but it is a tough racket.
Was there any point before Entourage came about that you were thinking about leaving the career?
100%. I mean, and by the way, I had made two movies that sold. I bought myself a $1 million house. I had a child. And suddenly, after Kissing a Fool came out, which again is, you know, Kissing a Fool was an independent movie. So nobody financed it except for some independent people. We sold it to Universal Studios. Again, in my opinion, they thought it was a home run. I did not think it should be released on 2,200 screens, which is what they did. I thought it should be like a small platform released. When that movie came out, where it should have been kind of hailed as an independent miracle, because it doesn't happen. You sell this movie. So everybody made some money on it that put the money in. But then Universal spent all the money to market it, and it didn't make money in the theaters. And I was dead. It was as if I had made a gigantic flop when the movie cost $1.5 million, because everything about it was kind of marketed as a studio film as opposed to a little independent movie with some, you know, we didn't really have movie stars in that movie. So I could not work. I had worked for probably 8 to 10 years, and suddenly I couldn't. I was like a leper in this town. I could not get anything. And, you know, Entourage was kind of a miracle. You know, I had started to, a friend of mine said I needed to get into TV. That was where all his friends who had little talent made millions of dollars. And I said, I don't know anything about TV. How do I get into it? And he told me to write a spec script of my favorite show, which it's nuts to think that Curb is still running now. But I just woke up in the morning and I wrote a Curb spec.
Real quick, for people that don't know, spec script is?
Like an independent version of your favorite show. Got I just it. Wrote it that nobody's ever going to, you're not going to make any money off of it. You're just showing people, I know how to write. I can write these characters or whatever. So I sent it to my manager, who was my friend from college, who was executive producer on Kissing a Fool, who had completely forgotten I'm even in the business. And I sent him the script. He's like, oh my God, this is hilarious. He goes, you know, Mark Wahlberg and I were talking about doing a show about his life. You know, you should write it. And again, Mark and Steve Levinson hadn't done anything in TV either. But I'm like, all right. And we sat down for lunch and they told me the idea for Entourage, which was a guy and his entourage, which I despised the idea because it's not how I live or ever would live. And I remember going, you know, which was similar to how Kissing a Fool happened, because Steve Levinson found me Kissing a Fool, which, you know, you talk about a way a guy does his business, but they offered Mark Wahlberg Kissing a Fool before I was involved in it. And his manager, Steve, said, the only way Mark will do it is if Doug Ellen writes and directs it, which was complete bullshit because Mark was never going to do it with me writing and directing it. He was never going to do it, period. But they're like, oh, okay. So they hired me. And then when we rewrote it, I said, you know what? Instead of Mark, how about David Schwimmer, who is one of my best friends? So we made that movie, but that's how I got the job. But when Entourage happened, we sat at this restaurant and they told me the idea. And the same thing I said about Kissing a Fool when I read that script and I was unemployed. I said, this is horrible. I'm not doing this. And I had nothing else to do.
It's ballsy when you're unemployed.
It's more stupid than ballsy because I will tell you that when you get offered to make movies,
take it.
But, you know, my manager, Steve, at the time was like, you'll figure it out. I remember those were just words. You'll figure it out. So I figured it out. We made the movie. Same thing happened with Entourage. I'm like, this is an awful idea. I hate it. He's like, you'll figure it out. And then I went home and I thought about how can I make it something that I'm interested in? And that's where it came from.
You have 5 new messages.
Hey, Carl, it's Jen from Finance. Could you submit your expenses this week?
Hey, Carl, happy Friday. It's Jen, Finance. Just need those receipts today.
Me again, Carl. Really need those receipts, like last week.
Please just tell me where they are. Are you by your desk right now?
Finance teams, you shouldn't be chasing down Carl or anyone else. With Ramp, expenses are sent with a text and reminders happen automatically. Switch your business to ramp.com today and love finance again.
And so what type of spin did you put on it to make it something that you're interested in?
Well, two things. Mark's crew was not family. They were not 40 years. He had people that he had, you know, kind of taken on as his Hollywood journey. So I'm like, if these are best friends since they're kids, you know, and they're like my friends, you know, more than Mark's friends. And they're like the guys that I grew up with who all, which, you know, it turns out, because, you know, when LeBron James did the show, he said to me, he goes, this is my E, this is my turtle, and this is my drama. And if you remember 10 years ago, maybe 15, Rich Paul and Maverick Carter, everyone thought it was a joke. What is LeBron doing having these guys run his life? As it turns out, they're all really good, you know, and they all actually helped his life. So I kind of looked at it like that way before that is, how can each of them have a useful purpose? And how can they really have some worth behind them that isn't just like guys who just hang on and take things from them? So that's what I brought to it.
When you decided to take it on, at any point, was there any convincing Mark Wahlberg to actually be in the show?
No.
Absolutely not. Under no
circumstances. Yeah. And again, you know, Mark was a movie star, but not quite like he is today. And also, you didn't do TV back then. I mean, there's many references on Entourage to a movie star doing TV is like the end of their career. So it's very different than in 2001 than it is now. But no, that wasn't even a thought.
Not even a thought. Okay. So tell me a little bit about the process though. So you decide to take on the role. Do you actually write the full season out, like one full season?
You have to today, not then, thank God. Because I, again, had no idea what I was doing. And you have to have luck and you have to have perseverance, as I said before. That meeting to sell Entourage, which if you look back to 2001, HBO is like the king. There's no Amazon. Yeah. There's no Netflix. There's nowhere. And this is not a network show. So it wasn't going to NBC. So it was basically going to HBO. They either say yes or no. And they have, I think, three shows a year that they put on or something like that.
Landing, you know, something like that. It's got to be impossible.
So the thought of going in there was like, all right. And we walked in there, which the Ari character that Jeremy Piven plays on the show, I had never met him. I had never heard of him. I had never seen him, but he represented Mark Wahlberg. So when we went into that meeting, and I had actually written in my treatment, which is like a stack of papers about what the show is going to be. Yeah. I had Jeremy Piven playing my agent, a guy named Jeff Jacobs at CAA. And Ari walked into this meeting and took over. And I didn't say one word. He walked in and he said, which I've talked about this on my podcast before, but he said, it's about Mark Wahlberg and his friends. This guy's going to write it. If it sucks, we'll fire him and someone will rewrite it. That's literally me while I was sitting there with all these papers ready to talk. And
was he in character doing this too?
He is a character.
Was he in his character of Ari?
He's even more interesting than the fake Ari on the show.
Okay.
And again, HBO was like, when we walked in, Levinson and I, Mark wasn't there. Like HBO was like this palace that you're like, I can't believe we're even meeting here. I can't believe we're in here. And Ari walked in. He's like, tell them I got 10 minutes or I'm getting the fuck out of here. And I'm like, holy shit. And we walked out and I got in the car and with Steve, we were in the same car and Ari called. He's like, they bought it. So I'm like, that's it. So what I didn't realize then, we honestly, if you remember Vanilla Sky with Tom Cruise walking around the streets thinking he owns the world.
Yeah.
Lev and I thought we owned the world. So now they pay me $50,000 to write a script. And for about 45 seconds, I thought, wow, we made it. We made it. We're at HBO. It's nothing. 2 years later, I'm still listening to their notes. We don't like this. We like that. I'm changing the script over and over and over. Mark, doesn't matter. Like, it's only if this script is something they want to make. That's it. So I did it over and over and over, really thinking, this is it. And when I asked them, which I really love you guys at HBO still, but I said, guys, I've been working on this. Like, you're basically paying me like minimum wage or less.
Because this is 2 years now you're working on this
script. 2 years, over and over.
How many hours a week are you putting into this? Just trying to get content.
You know what? It's hard to gauge that as a writer. All day and all night. Because I sit in the shower and I think about it. I wake up in the morning and I think about it. And I'm also, you know, they've got the biggest shows in the world. So they're not like spending a lot of time holding my hand. They're saying things and I'm trying to figure out am I allowed to curse them?
Yeah, what the fuck they're saying.
Trying to figure out what the fuck they're saying. And I remember, I mean, like a couple of things that happened, you know, Chris Albrecht, who I love to death, who really I credit with this show going forward because I don't think anyone else at HBO wanted it to. But he kept saying, and not to me, because I wouldn't even get like a room with him. They would just tell me, Chris says, it's not about funny, it's about fun, which sounds so obvious now.
Yeah.
But we used to sit around and go, is this funny or is it fun? Like, how do we make funny fun? And how do we do this? And how do we do that? So hours are countless. An obsession of how do we win? How do we get this done? And at one point, you know, I hired like the head of UCLA screenwriting to like oversee and give me thoughts. And I remember the day before because you would hand these scripts in and you'd wait 2 months before they'd even tell you what they thought.
Wait, real quick there, you hired someone. You're not using that $50K to hire someone.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah. Okay. I mean, not like enormous amounts of money, but you know, like a tutor.
Yeah.
$150 an hour, whatever it was at the time.
But just, you're just getting dwindled by the second here.
Yeah. Well, first of all, you got to pay the agent.
That's what I'm saying.
Got to pay taxes.
There's nothing left.
Nothing. Zero. I mean, and I have a child at this point, and I have $1 million house that I bought with the money when I thought I already made it 5 years ago. And now I'm not working at all besides this.
Damn.
So I'm writing and writing and writing, and I call them up and I say, guys, something, come on. They sent me $2,500 as a bonus. Okay, this multi-billion dollar
HBO.
So, but I kept going and kept going. And at one point, like I said, the UCLA screenwriter, who I just realized I haven't spoken to in a decade, and I forgot that she sent me a message about 2 weeks ago.
Hit her up.
So she's like, this is one of the best pilots I've ever read. It's amazing. Steve Levinson loves. This is amazing. Mark, this is unbelievable. We handed an HBO, and I remember sitting on my bed. I got my baby, got my German Shepherd next to me, and Lev calls me, and he goes, they don't like it.
Shit.
And I go, what don't they like about it? And he goes, they don't like anything about it. I'm like, oh, all right. And I remember I walked to the park with my dog. I sat down. I had two movies that had played around the world, good or bad, whatever the fuck you think about them. I don't give a shit. I'd made two movies that played around the world. I'd made enough money to buy this fucking house that I'm going to lose. And I'm sitting there. I'm like, that's it. I'm out of this business. Like I bought an LSAT book. I'm like, and by the way, I'm 30 now around, you know, I'm like, I guess I got
to
go
to be an attorney.
Yeah. I guess I have to be a fucking lawyer. Like, what am I going to do? And I said, all right, I'm taking one more swing at this thing. And I got in a car in August and went to Palm Springs and got a hotel room. And I rewrote the whole thing. One of the things that the executive said, which again, here's another difficult thing about the process. Chris is the guy who's ultimately going to say whether this show goes.
Yeah.
But there's people under him that try to guess what Chris wants and try to convince you to write something that Chris is going to ultimately want. So you're trying to figure it all out. And the thing that I remember that she kept saying to me is that these guys need to have their own language. They need to speak in a way that nobody else understands, which do you know what the fuck I'm saying when I say that to you? So I kept going, okay, they have their own language, whatever. And I went to the desert by myself and I wrote this script that was almost like another language that they talk to each other and they all understand each other.
Like, do you have to get like high to like think creative like this? Like, what do you do out there to start doing that?
You know, I God knows what I did, but I can tell you one of the saddest, lowest points of my life, being in the desert, in the middle of nowhere, pre-internet, by myself alone. And I said, you know what? I need some fucking porn. And there's no porn, there's no stores around here. There's no fucking internet. And I drove wherever it was. I found like one of those adult bookstores, if you even know what that is.
I know.
And I go to this place and I see like some porn stars that I recognize on a box cover.
Yeah.
And I take this thing. I literally drove 30 minutes and I drove back 30
to
minutes.
To pump off for 10 seconds.
And then you want to kill yourself like a drug addict. Like, what did I just do? But this was worse. And I fucking put this thing in. It might have even been VHS. I don't remember. DVD, whatever the hell it was.
Yeah.
And it was, I don't know if you know what this is, the Pony Girls. Do you know what this is?
I must have missed that
They
one.
Stick like a fucking tail up their ass and a bit in the girl's mouth, and they go around on the floor, okay?
I missed that
and
one.
There's nothing sexual about it. I'm like, what the fuck is this? And I remember just sitting there going, I have hit rock bottom. I literally cannot fucking believe this is my life, but I write this script that I think is so fucking dumb.
Yeah.
And I give it to Lev. He's like, this is insane. What the fuck? Hands it in. And they go, now we're getting on track.
Wow.
Okay, now I'm telling you that the ultimate pilot that was shot at HBO is 80% what I wrote before that. But whatever I did here got them engaged enough to start going, okay, we're moving in a direction.
Okay.
And then, you know, I just kept going and going and going until we got there. And
how long is that for start to finish? 50,000 plus you get the 2,500. So you're 52,500 until they accept it.
I would say,
process?
I mean, I'd have to look exactly, but I would say from the time we walked into HBO, which you got to remember, there's 3 months before that, that I'm trying to figure out
get the meeting.
What it is, get the meeting, 2 years to be on set and shooting this pilot.
Okay. You know? And when HBO signs off, what exactly at this point are they buying? Are they
a pilot?
Okay.
So now I get another maybe $75,000 and we're going to shoot a pilot, which will take 6 months. And if it doesn't go, if they don't like it, that's it. Goodbye.
And thanks. when they're advancing all this money in the contracts.
Well, you're at 125 grand.
You're at 125. Yeah. All this money over 3 years sitting on an entourage. Yeah. Who do you still have ownership of the show or not? Like, do they own the show?
I have my points. You know, I have what I own, which I think I don't know, somewhere around 15%.
Okay.
But it's points of nothing. It's completely worthless.
Fluff. It's nothing.
Yeah. Okay. And if it doesn't go, there's a world. Again, there's not another network that could take it, but there's a world I can go show it to people and they go, oh, we like it. We'll hire you for something else where we can torture you for another 3 years. But the goal is to get on HBO. That's it. There's nothing else there. And by the way, not even that. It's to get to season 5.
Okay.
You know, before you can really start going, okay, I made some real money now, you know?
How do you get a Jeremy Piven or some of these people who have, you know, some sort of credibility in the space to shoot a pilot when budget is pretty limited? Or does HBO start paying pretty good salaries?
No, they didn't pay him shit.
How do you sell him on it?
Jeremy, I wrote him in before we had ever started casting this thing.
Yeah.
And then, you know, I want to get him in. And while you think he's a big name, HBO didn't think he was a big name. They're like, he needs to audition. And I'm like, I know how to write for this guy. He doesn't need to audition. And Jeremy refused to audition. He's like, I'm not auditioning. I'll meet. So I met with Jeremy and, you know, I convinced him. Now I still had to convince HBO.
Yeah.
And thank God for the real Ari, because there was another guy who read for Ari, who was very good, by the way, but not even in the same league.
Yeah.
And they were like, he's fine. And I called Ari and I said, Ari, I know more than anything on the planet Earth that I know how to write this guy. And this is the guy. And Ari called HBO and said, this is the guy, put him in. So
were there any main characters that we saw in Entourage that got put in last minute or that were not there for the pilot?
No.
Okay. So they were all there from day one.
But things that Kevin Dillon, who I thought stole the pilot. And from the second he auditioned, I was like, this guy's a superstar. I'm lucky that he hasn't been doing comedy. HBO did not like him.
Interesting.
And it took a few weeks where it was kind of like, you know, they said, all right, you know what? It's your show. Do what you want. And you go, fuck, if we make this pilot and they don't like it, that's it. It's over, you know? So
they liked the pilot though.
Well, they ultimately liked the pilot, but again, that was a process too. We were up against, I think, was it Linklater? Linklater had a pilot.
Okay.
And they were picking up one. You got one of the biggest filmmakers in the world. And I keep getting told they're picking up one. And I'm just like, we're dead. I can't believe this. What a waste of fucking time. And one day they called up. They said, let's go. And that's when the real fun starts.
You've done it again, finance teams. You closed the books and it went fine. Sure, some expenses were missing receipts, but that's fine. Stayed late to process invoices by hand. It's all fine. But don't you deserve better than fine? With Ramp, expenses are submitted with a text, invoices are coded automatically, and everything is connected to your accounting system so you can close the books without all the busy work. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.
And then they commit, when they say let's go, that's
seven
a commitment
more.
To what?
Seven One, episodes.
Seven episodes.
Yeah.
What type of money do they put up front for that?
I mean, the budgets on our episodes, you know what, we're probably $3 million an episode probably, which is low.
Okay. That's low in the industry.
That's low. You know, I mean, I don't want to give the wrong numbers, but Game of Thrones is probably like 25 to 30 an episode. I mean, obviously it's a much bigger type of, you know, special effects hour drama, but yeah, we were low. Whatever the number was, we're low. The actors were getting, you know, as low as you could get for season one. I, as a showrunner, was getting as low as you could get for season one. And
what is that? Well, these actors, as low as you can get season one, what is that number? I have no idea what that would be.
I don't know what the actors were getting. I made, I think, about $300,000 for season one.
Okay.
You know, to work 24/7. Yeah. On a show that was going to play all around the world, you know? So, which, by the way, couldn't have been more thrilled about at the time, you know?
If you had to guess, would you say the actors made more or less than the 300 grand?
Less.
Less.
Yeah. They probably made somewhere between 25 and 35 an episode, probably.
But you still have your points. Do actors or actresses, do they get
points? Unless they have that kind of power, but none of them.
But none of them get points. No. Okay. And then after the first season, did you know it was going to be just an international phenomenon?
I'm a neurotic Jew. I'm like fucking every day. I'm like, they're canceling us. I mean, actually, in fact, you know, all the DVRs started coming around then. So like we would see articles, the ratings were like not what Sex and the City was 4 years earlier. And I'm like, oh my God. So every day I was like, we're getting canceled. And we were shooting in Vegas for season two. And I have no, like, my head is down. I am just like, make this fucking
thing work.
You're in
deserts, right? And
that's
trying
it.
To find a little shot.
And we were shooting at the Hard Rock at the pool. And when the guys walked out to shoot the scene, and the entire East Coast meathead contingency of people in the Hard Rock pool started fucking going nuts. Turtle, Vince. I was like, holy shit. So that was the first time I had any idea that anyone was even watching this show. Now, we had gotten really good reviews, which was amazing. So I don't think HBO thought this was like a review show or an Emmy-worthy show. I think they thought it was like their tits and ass show, you know? Which now the world has sort of changed it to like, that's what it was. But we were, you know, the New York Times called us the smartest show on TV. We got nominated for a Golden Globe that year. Our reviews were amazing all around, you know? But it was not until that Vegas thing. And even then, I'm like, our ratings suck. And Chris called me, who again, I probably spoke to at that point in my life, maybe twice, Chris Albrecht. And he called me up. And he's like, how you doing? I'm like, you know, I'm fucking just want more people to watch it. He's like, are you fucking crazy? Like, you got a major hit here. We'll go as long as you want to go. Do as many episodes as you can possibly do. And I was like, okay. So that was the first time I felt some sense of security, which Chris ultimately ended up leaving HBO 2 years later, which everything changes when that happens. You know?
Yeah. How do you, once you have the success of season one, how do you then negotiate for season two?
I had Ari become my agent.
Stop it.
Yeah.
No way.
Yeah. I mean, when that first meeting at HBO,
yeah,
I said to Lev, I said, I want this guy to be my agent. And I remember him going, he's not gonna be your fucking agent. I'm like, I just sold the show to HBO. It's like, so you're gonna make $50,000. He's gonna make five.
Yeah.
I'm like, okay. And then we get, you know, Golden Globe nomination, picked up for season two. I'm like, I want Ari to be my agent. He's like, you're not ready. You know, he's not going to be your agent. So it wasn't until season three when it was time, because I think I had a 2-year deal or something, when it's time for a long-term deal.
Okay.
That he's like, Ari's ready. I go, well, what's he going to give me now? You
know? Yeah, yeah, so, yeah, yeah. Is that when it becomes like a 7-figure deal?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So that's when the big money comes in, season three. And that LSAT book is on fire now. You're not looking back at that.
Pretty much, yeah. You know, I mean, again, you know, you know, it's not, you know, it's not going to be, I mean, I made a lot of money, but it's not going to be Seinfeld money. You're on HBO, you're making, you know, we made 96 episodes, and it's not, even though we did syndicate, which where the real big money came in, which we never expected, but it's not syndication like Seinfeld or Friends, where you make $500 million, you know?
When you syndicate, because I was going to ask you, when you have 15 points of the show, when you go to ABC, is that when the 15 points gets paid off once you get syndicated?
Yep.
For whatever value that it's purchased at?
Yep.
Got it. Okay. Yeah. Is it fair to make, on without syndication, is it fair to say that you made over $10 million?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. But again, you pay $5 million in taxes. And I'm not trying to be like obnoxious about it.
I understand.
You know?
Yeah.
You know?
Totally.
And it's over years and years. Like we did... You know, we did 8 seasons in a movie of Entourage over 14 years, you know?
Yeah, right. Living in L.A. too.
Yeah, that's a whole living in L.A. thing. With kids.
Yeah.
You know, I had, you know, the Yankees star Mark DeShera says on my show, he's like, you know how much putting kids through Greenwich private schools cost? You know, so you have that in L.A. too, you know?
Yeah.
And again, I have plenty of money. I made plenty of money, but, you know, Larry David, who I, you know, is my boy and I love to death. I remember season 2 or 3, whatever it was, when we both lost Emmys to Desperate Housewives, which I still find fucking offensive. But we both lost, and we both marched out of the room. Or is it Golden Globes, one of the two? And I see Larry. I'm like, what are you upset about? He goes, what are you upset about? I go, I'm trying to fucking get Seinfeld money. You know, like I wouldn't give. I meant it. I won't give a shit about any of these awards if I could just get that kind of money. You know,
David Schwimmer, Larry David, Mark Wahlberg. You're clearly connected with some of the best actors in the entire planet. I got to go off the script a little bit. these guys, what is it that makes them so special? Are they just that talented? Is it their work ethic? Is it something they can do that someone can't? It's very clear. Like when we go watch golf, whatever it is, it's very crystal clear why that person's better than that person. With these actors, what is it?
I mean, obviously, much tougher thing. If you're in golf and you could, you know, shoot low, you shoot low.
Sure.
That's it. This is subjective. I knew when I met David Schwimmer 3 years before Friends. He auditioned for my short film. And he did one line. I said, done. You're it. And I told everyone I knew. I said, this guy will be one of the biggest stars in the world. That's what I believed,
but 100%. What is it, the it factor? Is it the tone?
It's an intangible, you know, talent. It's just talent. Now, Larry, again, you need luck. I don't care how talented you are. Larry was broke in his 40s. Larry was fired off of Saturday Night Live. You know, what's Larry's break? Jerry Seinfeld says, I want this guy to write my show with me, you know, when he's the biggest comic in the world. Without Seinfeld, who knows where Larry David is? So you need that luck, and then you need that talent, and then, of course, you need that work ethic. But there's a lot of talented people that don't make it for whatever reason, you know?
Yeah, you've had all three of those things at some point. For the people listening back home that haven't had any of those, what type of advice would you give them?
What do you mean, haven't had any what?
Just they haven't had the luck. They haven't had the break. They haven't been seen. They're still struggling. They're in the low of the roller coaster that you've experienced, that Larry experienced. Yeah. What do you tell those people when they're just lost?
It's a really hard thing because I've had conversations with friends of mine that, you know, ended our friendships because there's two things. You got to have some indication. Somebody's got to be encouraging you in some way that you're good at this. That's why, again, luck, my first short film sold, but it told me, okay, like people in this business believe I have something. So keep working. But I have friends who, you know, they've never worked and they still, you know, want to do it. And if you love it and if you're happy that way, great. But I think it's something that you have to, you know, one of the great episodes of television ever, which I stole a little bit on Entourage, but Taxi had this episode where I don't know if you know Taxi.
No, I don't.
That's tragic. Okay. Literally one of the best television shows ever. James L. Brooks, who's a Simpsons creator and Oscar winning director
and a
genius. And, you know, it's Danny DeVito and whatever. But
have you boys seen Taxi just to get a check here? You've heard of it.
Criminal.
We're fucking horrified right now.
So, but one of the episodes is they're taxi drivers who dream of bigger things. And one of them is an actor in Hollywood. And he says he's going to give himself 5 years. And it's like 5 years to the day. If I don't get a job, I quit and I go do something else, which every person in this town, pretty much, maybe not Mark, because Wahlberg had, you know, it all just go pretty well, pretty easily. But he gave himself 5 years and said, if I don't get something by that moment, then, you know, I'll move on with my life. The story is good and you should watch the episode. I won't give away the ending, even though it's 50 years old and you guys have never seen it. But, you know, you have to have some encouragement or you just have to love it and not care about the other things in life, like stability and security and all that stuff. But I think you asked at the beginning, what anyone could get into this business, which is a problem and a blessing because there's a lot of really uniquely untalented people clogging up the system, you know, that keep going and going. Uniquely and there's also relentless people who are untalented that just boom, boom, boom. I mean, the amount of scripts I get from people who are not in this business at all, who just think, oh, I could do it. I'm a lawyer. I'm a dentist. I'm a this, I'm a that. Read my script. This is a great movie. So, you know, I always tell everybody, if you do not love this more than anything in the world, do anything else. Because even in great success, which I've been fortunate enough to have a lot of, there is so much downtime and feeling like shit about yourself and rejection and debating what the fuck am I doing, no matter when it happens. I mean, you know, HBO didn't pick up my show after Entourage, which I still hate their fucking guts and I still know they were wrong. And I still see the shit that they put on now, a lot of it, and go, you got to be fucking kidding that they didn't, even if they didn't like it, let my audience get a chance to see it. So, but still, I remember that day I was in Israel, like going, God, I don't even know if I could grind this out for another 10 years. And I had this great show with Eddie Burns, Michael Imperioli, Michael Rapaport. And they called me up and told me they were passing on it. I honestly could not fucking believe it. I thought I had gotten to the point where they go, you're in.
Whatever you do.
Yeah. Check. And until it fails. Till like going. We turn it on and everybody hates it, but they didn't let me do it. So I have seen every up and down in this business, and it is it is not fun. So you really got to love it.
Good piece of advice, especially for people back home doing anything. That's such great advice. Two rapid fire questions I got to ask you, and then we'll wrap with Entourage. It would be one, celebrities. Who has been, you talked a little bit about some of these people are talented, untalented, but they're relentless. Who has been the best celebrity that you've had on as an actor? So whatever it is, they're an athlete, it's LeBron, but they act the best and you're blown away by their ability.
You know, I always said this, like I'll answer this differently every day, like whatever comes to my mind at the moment, because we had so many great people on.
Yeah.
And obviously when they're, you know, coming in from another venue, they're nervous, they're this, that, but you know, Tom Brady was amazing. You know, like came in and instantaneously kind of fit in. Mark Teixeira again, Yankees first baseman, was great. But Lamar Odom, who was our first like celebrity to even come on, because it was so hard first year and nobody knew who we were and they didn't want to do it. But we've had a lot of really, we were very fortunate in the directors that we got from James Cameron and Scorsese. And
it's incredible.
You know, so there was no one that I found that wasn't good and wasn't able to do what we needed them to do. But that was a lot of fun.
Okay, you took my next question. It was going to be, who's the worst? Now, product placement. It's huge now. We run a social media agency. We are doing deals left and right all over social media. You guys had placement left, right, and center.
Zero.
You weren't paid on any of that.
Zero. And I honestly, like, I know I credit myself with starting the celebrity tequila or liquor business. But that was my childhood friend. I was sitting in a jacuzzi in Nantucket over the summer, and I was trying to think up a business idea for Turtle. And my friend's like, we're starting a tequila company. I'm like, I love that. So I went with that, but not a single thing from the cars, which I met the president of Maserati who credited us. He said, you made the Quattroporte happen. Like that show made that car go.
That's like my dream car because of the show. $0.
Everything that was on that show was things that I liked or somebody on the show liked. I mean, I started putting Apple computers on before. Now, did we get hundreds of thousands of dollars in Apple computers for the writing staff for this and that? Yeah, but that's not why we did it. Everything that I did was to make it authentic to the time and place and to the products that I loved. So, and I think you feel that on the show because we're not selling you anything. We're going, okay, today's in a Ferrari, today's in a Maserati, today's in this, today's in that. But, you know, some good things that would happen. I mean, like on the movie, Mercedes is like, if Ari drives this car, you drive it for the year. I'm like, okay, done. You know, but I love the car. Otherwise, I wouldn't have done it if it didn't work for it.
It's just crazy to see like now when you see like George Clooney, Cosmigos going for $1 billion and like the products that could have been spun off from that show. It could have been a much, much bigger than
billions
the show.
And billions
of dollars.
But you know, HBO was they people paid so they would not look at advertising. Now people snuck shit in, obviously, in different ways and stuff. Yeah. But and Mike Meldman, who started Casamigos with Clooney, is a friend of mine. And you know, I mean, I saw him started from the get-go after Avion and after that happened. And now Mark's got one now. I forgot the name of it. And you know, my friend who did Avion has. He did the Rocks tequila. He did Conor McGregor's whiskey. So he's made several $100 million in this avenue that didn't exist 15 years ago. You know,
but it started with you. I love it. How about the Entourage movie? Grossed $49.3 million. How involved were you with the movie?
I mean, I wrote it, directed, produced it.
You did it all.
I didn't do it all. I have a huge, amazing staff, but I did what I do, you know. And
do you still get 15 points of that? Same thing?
It's different deals on that, you know. But, you know, I would have been very rich if the movie was very successful, but it wasn't. But really the goal with that movie, Sex and the City syndicated after the show ended.
Sure.
It did terrible. Nobody watched it. And then the movie came out and they re-syndicated for about 4 or 5 times. So I didn't want to do the Entourage movie. And Mark convinced me, we're going to re-syndicate. We're going to do this. We're going to do that. So we did it. And again, I mean, the movie walked right into the Me Too movement. So the reviews were like, insane, but I love the movie. So
do you consider the movie a success then in your eyes?
No, it's definitely not a success. I mean, you have to be financially successful or critically successful.
But
I had a good time making it. So.
And the abrupt ending, just the, you know, 8 seasons, at least from a fan, it seemed like an abrupt ending. Was there a business strategy, financial strategy, something we wouldn't know behind the scenes?
They canceled us.
Is that just what happened?
They fucking canceled us. We were their highest rated half hour by far.
Why do they do shit?
It's very simple ego. You got new people who came in and they may not like the show or whatever, but they want to put their imprint on. So they would rather spend their money on something new that they came up with, that they had a hand in. And they gave us 8 episodes And I said, I want 12. And they said, no. So
spinoff, reunion, sequel, anything coming?
Who knows?
You hear so possible. Much shit out there.
Yeah,
right?
I know.
Would you like that within your vision? Is that something you would like to achieve?
You know what? I love 97% of the people I worked with. So what I did with the new show, Ramble On, that was all my crew, a lot of my cast. I got Charlie Sheen also, who's awesome. But, you know, I like working with people that I like. So, sure, if it came about.
We only have a few more minutes with you, so I want to get in as much as I can. Ramble On, new TV show. Yeah. You're working on now the pilot. How have things in TV land changed from when you were working on Entourage 10, 15 years ago versus a show like Ramble On?
Well, we're really going to find out because nobody does what I did. I went and raised the money myself. I produced it myself. All of the nightmares of dealing with HBO and the development process, I wanted to skip over. So I wanted to go cast who I wanted, write what I wanted, and do it how I wanted. And we did that. Now, as you ultimately realize, which I still believe the time is coming where you can make your own show, distribute it yourself, and be able to make the money like Louis C.K. does or Taylor Swift does. But you need, because the budgets are so high, you need an enormous amount of people to purchase it to do that. So ultimately, you end up in the same place where you want a streamer, you want a Netflix, Apple, Amazon, Hulu, whatever. But it was an amazing experience. We have a great pilot. And unlike Entourage, where I didn't know what the fuck I was doing, we have a whole plan for what it is. And, you know, we've gotten some amazing responses from it. But we're asking for people to go, okay, give us $6 million an episode to go make more of these. And like I said with the HBO thing, we're asking people who had no involvement in it. Yeah. So when you go in, if I walked into Amazon today and said, here's my idea, they would get involved in the script, in the casting, and all of that. So this is a done thing that I'm going, here, take it.
All right, two last questions. Ramble On, you compare it to Entourage. How much of your budget did you have for Ramble On for the pilot?
I mean, I did it like a student film, even though it looks like all Emmy nominated and Emmy winning cinematographers, editors, all that stuff, but everyone did me favors. So people came in for as little as they could possibly afford to work with. So we did it probably 20% of what it would have cost if we actually shot it at a studio.
Okay. Got it. Doug, your story is so cool. I think you got to write a million books. I'd literally read them all, but you got to end and wrap with a trading secret. It's a secret no one can get from anyone else, a professor. They can't Google it. They can't go watch something on YouTube. They can only get it from your career. One trading secret for our listeners. What can you leave them with?
I think really love what you're doing or get out of this, because there's a lot of shit that you could be miserable doing and make a lot more money and have a lot more stability in life. So really, like, have a passion for what you're doing. And really, I believe in this business, don't, if you have something else you want to do also, go do that, you know?
Yeah, I like that. And I also like that timeline that you talk about people setting. Go all in, give it a shot, give yourself a timeline. Doug, where can people find everything that you have going on?
I got Victory the Podcast, wherever there are podcasts. We're doing live shows around the country and the world. We're going to Australia in August.
Sick.
And Ramble On, hopefully soon. We've got an amazing trailer I may put out on the internet soon. But hopefully that'll be on one of the streamers soon.
I love it. And if you put it on the internet, they'll follow you and they'll be able to see it.
Yeah, Mr. Doug Ellen on Instagram. I still am too old to really work with TikTok and whatever, but Mr. Doug Ellen on Instagram.
I think you've got it all figured out pretty good. Guys, go download Victory the Podcast. Doug, thank you for being on this episode of Trading Secrets. Ding, ding, ding. We are closing in the bell to the Doug Ellen Podcast, the creator, the founder of Entourage. David, I know you are a huge fan of the show. You have literally seen every episode of every season. So I'm so curious to get your take. What did you think of this episode?
I personally, David Arduin, I loved this episode. I know we have a little curse going on where when I love it, it flops. And if I don't like it, people love it. But this, I loved. I'm a huge Entourage guy. A little piece of information for people back home. Our group chat is called Entourage. Entourage 2.0. Me, you, Evan, and Hawk that we've had for 5-6 years off the show. I will let the people at home guess who's who out of those four and the characters if you know the show. But I loved it because the behind the scenes that he was giving us was incredible. And it almost makes me think I would love to see a show based off of Doug Ellen, because the names that he was dropping, you know, getting David Schwimmer before Friends to help him out with a short film, to the Mark Wahlbergs of the world, to then finally making it big, and just the stories he was sharing, Jay, there were little tidbits that I have that sometimes threw me in a time capsule of like, oh my God, I didn't realize it was that long ago, to just like the highs and lows of someone trying to make it in Hollywood. So I personally thought it was incredible.
Yeah, I mean, it's just fascinating to hear all the behind the scenes, kind of like how the entire show was pitched and then the failures of the pitch and then what he did to come back. I mean, the story in the desert was outrageous. Did not see that one coming. But it's also fascinating to hear the stories behind the scenes with some of these huge people like a David Schwimmer. You think about, like, this is the stuff that he's sharing and willing to share in a podcast. Just imagine the stories this guy has that he tells behind closed doors. And the big question I always think about still to this day is, like, how did a show that was having this much success, blowing it out of the water, every metric possible, end up just going off the air? Like, I feel like there are so many untold stories with what has happened and what did happen as to why the show is no longer. But David, what do you think, like, when you're thinking about this episode, I don't know, what are some of the, like, the key points that you're like, damn, I couldn't believe that, or I was thrown by that, or anything like that?
Well, I always love a little bit of a takeaway. Like, at the end of the day, I don't think you're listening to podcasts in 2024 if you're looking for some sort of motivation. And I think this provided it. Like, again, not telling everyone to do this, but 1 week away from going to law school, looks at his parents like, I can't fucking do this. I'm going to be stand up in LA. Like, I just love how he goes, you need talent and hard work. Like, if you lack a little talent, you make up for in hard work, right? Like, but if you have a ton of talent, you still need hard work. You know, like you said, everything starts in the mailroom. Just a perfect, like, example of someone, like, working his way up, just doing what it takes to get in the industry. I thought all of that was great. And now obviously it's Trading Secret, like, do something you're passionate about. If you are doing something that you're passionate about, if you're not making a lot of money at the time, it's okay because you're fulfilled. And if you're fulfilled and then you have hard work and you have passion behind it, you're going to get paid off. So as a takeaway, that was my favorite takeaway of the episode. What about you from your seat? Did you have any takeaways that you're taking with you or that really stuck out to you?
I think, and hopefully people back at home can find this relatable, when you see someone's resume and they've done something that is just so outrageously successful and such an outlier, you always think, I can't do that either. Right? You're just like, I couldn't do that. But what if I told you that the guy who started and created and wrote one of the most successful TV shows ever to be on TV nationally and internationally was a dropout from law school who tried to do a stand-up comedy, right? Like, I think if you can tap into whatever you wanted in your life to tap into, you're capable of it, right? And he found ways in weird places at weird times to, like, tap into the place he needed to go to then write one of the best shows of all time. So everyone's got it. It's just like, can you find it within yourself? Like, that's my takeaway. And I also think about this. Like, there's so many things you could do in your life, and there's so many things you'll do in a weekend, and there's so many things you'll do this summer, and there's so many things you'll do this fall and winter. And you think about, like, places you got to go and weddings you got to go to and, like, work things you got to get done. But I think it's kind of cool to really take your energy and focus on something that forever will be part of, like, why you're respected. As long as Doug Ellen is alive, he will always, in the Hollywood and creative and media space, be so respected for the accomplishment of creating one of the best shows and writing it of all time. And I think if anyone is listening to this and you can think about, am I creating energy and tapping into something that could be, like, the best of all time, and whatever the fuck it is, whatever it is, that's one thing I think we should all think about.
Well, you always want something to hang your hat on too. That's, like, your life's work. Like, at the end of the day, your life's work might be a career, it might be a passion project, it might be how you help the community, it might be how you helped influence your family or your friends. Like, he's kind of seeing the swan song of this and getting his gang back together for his new venture, which is really exciting, like you said. But you could tell, it's so funny, like, we are talking about one of the most successful TV shows of all time. I know he referenced, like, Seinfeld money, but you got to think, maybe it was timing of it all. Maybe it was that he felt, like, a little slighted, but you got to think, with how successful it was, he missed out on a lot of money. Now, he's talking about $10 million and he joked about, like, $5 million goes to taxes, but it sounds like such a big number, but he said 14 years in the making.
Yeah.
Like, you got to think, for a show of this nature, he said egos got in the way, to your point of, like, why it just abruptly stopped. He didn't want to make a movie. He said the movie really didn't make a bunch of money. If it did, he said he would have been, you know, would have been much more well off. But, you know, when you really put it together, it just seemed like, despite the success, the dollars and cents that we always talk about didn't really line up. And I think you got a feeling from that from him. He was very grateful. He's very generous, but it wasn't like, you know, he wasn't sitting back resting on his laurels.
I talked to Johnny Drama because I've got to do a couple golf outings with Kevin Dillon, and I've talked a little bit about this. And he always regrets and like gets pissed at the fact that they didn't have social media back in the day. And he's like, dude, if we had social media then, I'd be good forever. But Johnny Drama, every place I go, like I've gone two or three places, two different tournaments. One was a dinner, then the golf place, and a couple others. Everyone fucking knows him. People line up to take pictures with him. He's funny. He's got everyone laughing. And he's like, yeah, but look it, man. I got 100,000 followers on Instagram and I can't monetize off it. And where he monetizes still to this day is like he'll do these golf outings and he gets paid for them. He's going to like comic shows. He'll go to big like TV show things, right? So it's interesting to see how times have changed and what the impact could have been if a show like that was around today.
I mean, he's grinding. Yeah. Like, it's nice that they have this to grind off of. But at the end of the day, they're grinding, which is kind of crazy.
Like, he told me, David, when you talk about grinding, he told me he's going from that golf tournament, he was going to a horror shop convention. He's paid a few bucks to, like, sit at a table. I was like, a horror? I was like, what horror movie were you in? He's like, bro, I was in The Blob, man. I was in The Blob, you know? So it's, we even talked, and he's going to come on the podcast a little bit. And he's had, trust me, the guy has had a very successful acting career in a lot of big movies. But he has said, like, I don't think it's tough to have, because the business side of it, when your brand becomes so big from one role on a show, it is kind of hard to pivot out of that role. Like, he's almost always Johnny Drama, and it's tough to pivot out of that.
Yeah, and you can only have so many Johnny Dramas in your life at one time.
I'm glad I got one.
Yeah, exactly, which I can relate to. But, you know, it's just crazy. You know, to think about the dollars and cents, not only in missing out on the social media and the influencing, but you guys talked about like the zero product placement on the show, Maseratis, the turtles driving the Cadillacs, and like you said, he's responsible for like celebrity influence alcohol brands with kind of what they started on the show, which was really cool.
And take that back to, if you guys have not listened, go back to some of the early episodes, Trading Secrets. If you have not listened to the Rob Dyrdek episode, where you learn that he has made his fortune on all brand placement into MTV shows early on in his career, that is fascinating. And you fast forward to 2024 and you think about where today can you be catching opportunities where in 10 years they'll catch them. But 2024, you're like, shit, I missed that. That's one thing I think we could all think about.
100%. You know, just thinking back on this episode and him in his negotiation room with HBO, having the real life version of Ari Gold going in there, doing his thing. The fact that he went out to the desert, he bought an LSAT book. He's like, fuck this. I'm packing up. I can't do this anymore. You know, bought a $1 million house because he thought he was sweet and he's just grinding to make it. I just thought all of that was incredible, man. It makes me want to go back and watch the show.
And I think real quick, the one when, like, to think about him and Ari Gold, Jeremy Piven, in, you know, like, selling this show in the room, that's the scene out of a show, too. Like, I thought that was such a cool story as well.
Exactly, which is why I would love to see a Doug Ellen movie or TV show that shows that, like, another lens behind the lens. But you talk about HBO. The show obviously blew up on HBO 8 years. Two questions for you. One, does HBO rerun? Do they do reruns? Are they getting any kind of like royalties, do you know, of this show being still on the air? Like, you see a Friends, you see a, you know, How I Met Your Mother, you see a Grey's Anatomy, like shows that are getting these reruns that people are still making tons of money off of. Do you know if Onourage has that? And then number two, the word syndication came up a bunch and points came up a bunch. I'm pretty sure points equals equity that he had in the show. Syndication, I think I may have asked on the Rob Dyrdek, but my old brain is failing me. So talk to me about the royalties. Talk to me about anything like that might happen for reruns, and then how syndication really affects these types of shows.
I mean, what's crazy is like your question actually it's the same answer. So syndicating a TV show is exactly the process of like rerunning it. So
making sure it's on air forever.
Yeah. So a television like show, right, is built, created, and then this was put on HBO. But then a different television network will actually buy the show to run reruns on their network because it's so successful. So that is where the money is made from syndicating a show. Now, one of the other things you talked about is, I looked up some of the numbers I talked about in the intro a little bit. This wasn't just a success in the United States. It was an international hit. And even in their movie, which, you know, Doug talked about, wasn't the biggest out there. But in 2015, the Entourage movie did $46 million in box office sales, and 14 million of those were international. So tons of success with the show. I know the movie wasn't as big as they wanted it to be, especially when you compare that to, like, you know, the big Spider-Man, Superman, or like in even in Entourage, Aquaman numbers. But clearly a show that was extremely successful, and that's how syndicated shows work. And that's why, you know, Friends, they were making so much damn money because they syndicated out at such a high value, and the ratings still were there from generation to generation.
At the end of the day, this is the dream. Everyone listening has their group of friends. It might be family. It might be their college friends. It might be their work friends. It might be the friends that they made, you know, now that they have kids, and they hang out with their kids, friends, parents all the time. At the end of the day, you have a movie and a TV show made about you and your best friends living your life, all making each other better, all, you know, doing in business together and having the fun times together. I think that is like the dream. I think that's why the show became so popular. I think everyone could relate in like a dream setting. And I'm around 16, 17 year old hockey players all day, and most of them have never heard of Entourage. It breaks my little heart. So that's to aging us a little bit. And hopefully the show does get syndicated so we can educate all those youth out there about Entourage.
I love it. Hell of a show. Really, really interesting guest. Hope you guys enjoyed this. Totally different than anything social media related. So we're tapping into all different careers and stories. Please give us 5 stars in the reviews. Make sure you subscribe to our YouTube channel and our Instagram. And as always in the reviews, give us some feedback and let us know what guests or subjects you want us to cover. David, thank you for being here for another episode, and we hope this was one you couldn't afford to miss. Bringing that money.